It's time to kick back and grab a beer, because the space cadets are here. Talking about space and the universe, let's all be giant science nerds. We're the space cadets, yeah, we're the space cadets.
Hey guys, welcome back to episode 5 of the Space Cadets podcast. Today we're going to be talking about our favorite extraterrestrial visitor, slowly orbiting our blue planet and keeping us in check in the solar system. That, of course, is the moon. And with me today, I got my three amigos, Nate, Alex, and Mark. What's up, guys?
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
So I got a question for you guys. When it comes to the moon, there's obviously a lot of conspiracy theories, and I'll save us the discussion on werewolves and things like that. But there is a myth that people get a little crazy during a full moon. Do you think there's any real science behind that?
Yeah, they're called lunatics.
That is where the term came from. I feel like the tides could impact people, which would obviously correlate with the moon. Although, would that really impact moon phase? I guess not.
Well, I'll tell you what, man. Phase, I don't know. I think that's probably in people's heads. But the fun fact that I had heard is that tidal forces, the difference between the pull during a high tide when the moon is closer versus different parts of your body and the distance thereof, can in some cases, they say, maybe make people a little crazy if your brain's getting pulled in one direction more than the other. Do I think that that's real? No, probably not. But I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah, they've done some studies on this, and scientifically speaking, there's no evidence, but people believe what they want to believe.
Yeah, but what's science really when it comes down to it?
So Alex, I'm glad you chimed in there, because I would love to go to you to begin this discussion today. We have a little bit of structure behind the conversation, but where better to start when we're talking about the moon than the actual creation of the moon? And one of the leading hypotheses to where the moon came from is that it didn't start off as a moon at all.
Yeah, Todd. So I think you're talking about Theia, which was a protoplanet about the size of Mars that the scientists think collided with Earth early on and created the moon. So the reason they think this, and it was kind of a mystery for a while, is that when they were first surveying the moon and taking measurements, they found that the iron core on the inside is much smaller than other planets, other moons that are rocky in the solar system. So do you guys know why? What they posited was the reason for that. Obviously, we know Theia, but what about Theia?
What would make sense is that in the collision, obviously that was a pretty intense event that probably caused a lot of turmoil in the solar system. I would guess that whatever was inside of Theia found its way outside of Theia and into Earth. And I think I've read something somewhere that says that the Earth actually has a larger core than most planets of our size.
I don't know if the Earth's core is bigger, but you're mostly onto the right answer there from what I've read. It was a glancing blow, they think. And if you think about how that must have worked, it kind of just gouged out a huge side of the Earth, but mostly just the crust and the mantle, so not the inner metal core. And that a lot of that became what is now known as the moon. That theory explains this kind of conundrum that scientists had, because if the moon was caught or was formed by natural forces, that metal inside should be the exact same size as other planets.
Tell me about this though, right? Because I know there's conflicting theories of whether it was a glancing blow or a direct blow, and I think the most recent one is actually saying that it might have been more of a direct blow than we originally thought. What I had said previously about it, our core, the Earth's core, being a bit thicker than you would expect on a planet of our size, I think that's one of the reasons why they're thinking that it's a combination of what you said, the fact that the moon does not have as big of a core as they would have expected, and the Earth's a little bit bigger. It makes more sense that it would have been more of a head-on collision, because it would have been even more catastrophic and created even more opportunity for that material to be deposited elsewhere and outside of the planet itself.
Panspermia.
No, but Mark, that's a good point. So you just mentioned panspermia. One of the other things I read recently is that a lot of the water that appears on Earth, they think probably came from Theia. and with water comes life. And so who knows if that wasn't true.
That is a very interesting thought.
I think you are correct, Todd, that they also think that the Earth's core is large because it merged with Theia's core. And then a lot of the debris that shot off was formed into the moon. So good call. Good call, man. So there's a few more interesting theories on how the moon might have formed. Most of them are discredited by now because Theia is the one that explains the most about the moon-Earth situation. But have you heard about the capture theory?
No, I haven't. What's that?
That was the original theory, is that the moon was a passing large body in the solar system and got captured by the Earth's gravity. So it came too close and then just started orbiting the Earth. But when they calculated the numbers, it just didn't make sense. You know, the gravity just didn't make sense for it to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that being tough. You know, you think about our International Space Station or just spacecraft in general orbiting the Earth and their mass and speed. The Theia collision, I think they're saying, happened at like less than 10,000 miles an hour or kilometers an hour. I can't remember. But substantially, you know, not that substantial of speeds, I should say. And the mass of a passing celestial body to me seems like something that would very easily escape the velocity needed to get out of orbit around Earth. One of the things that I thought was super interesting is, I believe it was 1959 that we sent, actually, the first humans, it wasn't us, it was the Soviet Union, sent a satellite, the Luna 2, shout out, Mark, to your daughter, Luna, the Luna 2, to the far side of the moon, and they noticed some substantial differences between the surface of the dark side of the moon and the surface of the light side of the moon. And the light side, which is always exposed to us because the moon is what is called tidally locked to the Earth, we noticed that there is more what is called mara on our side, right, which are these basaltic plains and clearly seen lava flow channels facing us, as well as not as many impact craters. And then if you look at the backside, it's peppered like somebody was just taking a shotgun all day and shooting at the dark side of the moon. So that left a huge question. There's no real fundamental difference between the dark side and the light side of the moon, other than one's always facing Earth. So do you guys have any idea what maybe caused that to happen? I think it's one of the coolest things. I just learned about it.
So, I mean, my theory there would be that the reason there are more craters on the back would be that it's the side where things can hit it. Nothing's going to hit the side that's facing us, because anything that would have hit the moon would have first hit the Earth or burnt up in its atmosphere.
Well, that's absolutely true. But what would account for the difference of the side that faces us being more rich in lava deposits and basaltic materials versus the back of the moon just being dust and craters?
Lava monsters.
Well, that was the original theory that was proposed.
And the Mara you're talking about would be the eyes and the mouth of the man in the moon, right?
That's it. Yeah, it's those. Thanks for calling that out. Those dark plains that you see facing us. You know, they almost look like oceans. Pop quiz, what does Maria mean?
Sea.
That's right.
Yes.
Alex, 1 point. Excellent job. Yes, it's Latin for the word seas. But the reason or the theory that they say that this is the case is that after that collision of Theia and Earth, the Earth was just a complete inferno of lava and magma. Like, this wasn't a meteor hitting one area and causing some destruction. This was an entire reshaping of an entire planet. And so our Earth turned into this magma-rich fireball. And as a result of that, it cooked everything around it, including the side of the moon that always faced the Earth. What happened was the heat, the radiant heat from our Earth after that collision, just started cooking and cooking that one side of the moon. And that's why they think that the side that faces us is so much different than the side that faces away. Isn't that awesome?
What? Space Daddy dropping knowledge.
We mentioned that the moon is tidally locked with Earth, and that we always just see one side of it. So let's now talk a little bit about mechanics of the moon. If you had to guess, Nate, what percentage of the moon do we see with our eyes?
More than 50%.
That's right. That's absolutely right. It's about 59% of the moon. And you wouldn't think that to be the case because it's always at one side facing us and it's just one half of the moon.
You're taking us back to Earth science, sixth grade here. Brutal.
Sorry, man. I'll try and give you a better experience than you maybe had in high school. Do you know what it's caused? What it's called, rather, when
the wiggle, cosmic wiggle.
That little cosmic wiggle. It's very similar to the dance moves I've seen you do at weddings many a time. It is. It's called a libration.
The vibration.
The libration.
It's like a libation combined with a vibration, which again goes back to the dance moves at weddings. So you could call your wedding dance move the libration or the cosmic wiggle.
That's a great word. Are there any companies or has anyone adopted the word libration for use on Earth?
Patent pending called it.
Libration.com. It kind of sounds dirtier than it is. I don't know. That seems to me like it's a website that would be not allowed on high school networks, you know?
Yeah, you definitely get flagged for that one.
Did you guys know that as much as we love our moon, that it is moving away from us each year?
Oh, no, that's so sad.
No.
Yeah, it's slowly leaving us as quickly as it showed up. It's making a journey away from us due to the tidal friction. So the fact that it's orbiting and, you know, our gravity is actually slowing down its orbit and giving it a little bit more opportunity to move away because it's constantly getting tugged by all the other larger, more gravity-intense planets in our solar system. So yeah, it's moving away at about 3.8 centimeters per year.
Wow, that's actually more than I thought.
So my question is, what is going to happen once the moon slips out of our gravitational pull? What's going to change on Earth without the moon?
Well, in 180 million years, our days will be 25 hours long, not 24.
So that's a good question, and I think another way of asking it is, like, was the moon integral to the establishment of life on Earth because it created certain conditions here just by being there that maybe were important for life to develop the way we know it?
I would say that life would probably be very different without the moon. It creates explain
what you mean, Nate.
Well, first of all, the tides. And the tides have to do with the shoreline. The shoreline is where the aquatic life first crept onto solid Earth. So maybe some of those forces were part of the evolutionary process.
Think too about nighttime predators. Without the moon, the night sky would be nearly pitch black. You know, there's not enough light coming from stars to really illuminate much.
So what does that affect? What happens now that we're like an established society? You know, let's say it was in 10 years, the moon was just going to go away. Do you think that it would have any real adverse effect because we have, you know, the ability to make our own lights and so on and so forth?
Great question. So in this scenario, is it going away slowly or does it just vanish?
Well, I'd say either. I mean, if it just vanishes, I think that would have some crazy effects on the oceans. You probably get a gigantic tidal wave on one side of the Earth. But assume, like, pretend that nothing catastrophic happened from it just poofing out of existence in terms of like a giant wave destroying everything. So yeah, let's say that, or it slowly backs away.
Well, one thing is we don't know yet just how important it's going to be as a jumping off point for exploration and the rest of the solar system and what kind of infrastructure we're going to put there. So
yeah, I was thinking more about effects of like what would actually happen on Earth. And I mean, to that point, I think there would be a lot of social media posts and people would be like, oh, remember the moon and all that stuff. But yeah, that cosmic exploration point, I think is brilliant, Nate, how we've been talking about using the moon as a gas station of sorts or a moon base alpha. Not having that could be devastating to the future of the human race and, you know, the idea of becoming an interplanetary species.
So are there materials on the moon that would be conducive for refueling rockets or building more things to explore space?
There is actually, yeah, in a lot of the craters. So here's what's really interesting. We envision heat on Earth because we have an atmosphere, right, where there's light that comes in, the light energy from the sun, and it gets trapped in our atmosphere, and we perceive that as heat in a very simplistic example. When you look at the moon, there's no atmosphere, and so that light will hit the surface and reflect off and bounce straight back. That's why the moon looks so bright. But in the direct sunlight on the moon, it is very, very warm to anybody receiving that light. But as soon as you move into a shadow, there's no atmosphere to keep and hold on to that heat that usually travels within the light from the sun. And as a result, things like water have the ability to not evaporate on the moon. And thus, there is actually very large billions and billions of tons of water coalesced inside of these craters in the dark side and some of the light sides of the moon where the light isn't directly hitting it. So that water could then be broken down and used for rocket fuel, which is, I think, one of the plans that both NASA and a lot of other titans of industry like Blue Origin and SpaceX are looking to capitalize on as sort of a gateway point between the Earth and the rest of the solar system.
That's fascinating. And I suppose by water you mean ice, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It is very, very frozen.
Just bottled water up there.
Yeah.
Aquafina.
What did you say, Dasani?
I went with Dasani. Alex went Aquafina.
Nice. Like Dasani's made in Brooklyn, if I'm not mistaken.
So the moon is a reflective surface to electromagnetic waves, and there's actually like communities of amateur, I guess, people on Earth who are sending signals up to the moon, bouncing it off, and receiving it back, and it takes like 2 or 3 seconds.
Like, so what's the purpose of that though, Nate? Like, what are they looking to just to see if they could do it?
Yeah, to see if they can do it, and then I don't know why anyone would do that.
Just to feel important. Well, but Nate, you know what they are doing, or considering doing rather, is they're sending up these satellites as part of some of the moon missions in the future. And what they want to do is have those satellites orbiting the moon. And when they get to the backside of the moon that doesn't face us, the dark side, that they can start taking photographs of the solar system and the universe, as well as sending out radio signals that are going to be less impeded by some of the other radio signals that we're currently transmitting from Earth. They think it'll be less signal pollution by doing it from the moon, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And I was reading this incredible book called Next 100 Years by George Friedman. And he hypothesizes a future where all warfare is done by satellites surrounding Earth. But there could be a scenario where we put enough military infrastructure on the moon, and then you could launch a secretive counterattack from the moon back at the Earth. And he foresees that happening in the years 2050 or 2060 or thereabouts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you could really claim ownership over something that you'd be, very few people could get to and attack, right? Like if you get the moon and you're there, first of all, you could see anybody coming at you to take it back from you, but also, there's not going to be that many people that could just like come over a hill and say this is now our territory and fight you for it.
Great point.
Yeah, so there's something called the Outer Space Treaty. Signed in 1967, which forbids countries from claiming any celestial bodies, at least, annexing it to their countries. But certainly people could still build bases or use these things for military purposes without claiming the land. And did you know you can buy parcels of the moon online?
I think that's the best business idea in the world, is telling people that you are going to sell them the moon. That's like saying, I'll sell you the Golden Gate Bridge or whatever that.
Right. I mean, it's a sham. But there's an American entrepreneur who sells lunar real estate. And if you want to buy a 1 acre plot of land on the moon for around $20, you are welcome to do that. Apparently, people such as Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan have both done this. So.
When we go to the moon, though, am I going to be able to walk up to that plot and be like, you can't build here?
Absolutely not.
No.
There's non-binding.
So I love this American entrepreneur. This is like the modern day snake oil that he's selling over here. In 1969, the USA landed our first humans on the moon during the Apollo 11 missions. There have been a total of 6 manned U.S. Landings between 1969 and 1972. And none since. And that has spawned a ton of conspiracy theories. Nathan, one of our favorite space cadets here, I think you might fall on the side of we did not land on the moon. Did I hear that correctly before?
So I have encountered many non-believers, people I've worked with, people I've met. And they've said some pretty persuasive things that have made me certainly think twice about we landed on the moon. And there's all a whole host of questions that come up. I'm sure you can share those. And I'm looking forward to hearing some of the ones you may have uncovered in your research. But some of the common conspiracy theories I've heard have to do with our lack of computing power in the 60s and 70s. And so how they could even calculate the orbits given the primitive nature of computers at that time. Personally, I think listeners at home could go and on YouTube and look up the Apollo 17 mission, the liftoff from the moon in December 14th, 1972. I mean, I hope I'm not out of line to say it kind of looks like it was filmed in a studio. It looks like the little pod was being lifted up on a fish line. There's no rocket propulsion to be seen. How is there a camera on the moon that's panning up and sending those signals? It raises a lot of questions.
Well, there's certainly questions, and you're right. I do have some of the more common hoax proof points written down here with some research, but let's talk about the ones you just brought up there to start. So the calculating gravity and the trajectories, that was all stuff that has been through the years with astronomers calculated with much less technologically savvy equipment. I mean, you go back to the 1400s, we had scientists there that were predicting not only that the Earth was rotating a certain way or that different planets were moving around the Earth in certain ways, but the existence of planets that they couldn't see just from the use of inference and the way that the things that they could observe were behaving. And so, you know, even in that early time in the 60s where, you know, we didn't have near the amount of technology we had today, I think the lunar lander had as much technology in it as an iPhone has today for the first iPhone. Maybe even less
like
than
the computing power of a calculator.
That's right. Like a TI-83, right? A TI-83 calculator had as much computing power as the lunar landing module. That's why it was so dangerous back then. But I think I don't have any proof for you, but I think we had the means to do it just because we've spent so much time analyzing our universe and figuring these things out. And also realize this wasn't the first time that we sent something to the moon. We had plenty of data from previous missions of just analyzing and orbiting and observing the moon that I firmly believe that you know, we were able to do that at that point.
Yeah, and I think to what you're saying, recently there were a series of articles about some techno geeks who've found some of the old computers that were used, like the Apollo guidance computers, and I think they were in the process of getting those up and running. So they'd found them, they dusted them off, and I'm not sure how those efforts panned out, but I think they were working on it.
Oh, that's cool. All right, well, maybe that'll put to rest some of the conspiracy theories one way or the other.
Let's be honest here. We landed on the moon. Come on. There's a million things, a million pieces of evidence. They've taken photographs of the area. People were monitoring the flights, multiple other countries. The Russians were monitoring the spaceships. We landed on the moon.
I'm pretty confident we landed on the moon, but what most people don't realize is that the moon is flat.
Is that why those solar eclipses on Earth are just gigantic bands of darkness instead of circles?
Pretty much, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's funny there's no flat moon society.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if we go to the moon, we're going to bring the flat earthers with us at some point.
So, and Nate, your other point about the Apollo mission where you see the lander take off, one of the common conspiracies that we often hear is that this moon landing was taking place inside of a production studio. And even in some of our best vacuum containers that NASA has, especially back in the day, if you think about it, you would have seen some kind of dust, clouds, or plumes pop up from the surface and stay there for a bit. You know, if you go into even on the movie Apollo 13, you can see some of that in some of the filming locations. When you see that lander take off from the moon, there's no disturbance because there's no wind resistance or air for the dust particles to get caught in. They fall immediately back down to the surface. And the fact that that thing can, you know, just kind of float up there is more due to the fact that it takes less thrust to get something out of the gravitational grips of the moon than it would the Earth. And being that there's no air resistance, it's very easy to just kind of shoot yourself up there, and the escape velocity doesn't have to be nearly as powerful as it would down here.
5,324 mile an hour escape velocity. or 2.38 kilometers per second.
That's actually a lot faster than I thought it would need to be.
Yeah, what's the Earth's?
So the Earth's escape velocity is about 11.2 kilometers a second. So what did you say the moon's was, Mark?
2.38.
Oh, wow. So it's like five times. That's crazy. But that makes sense. So, yeah, I mean, and that actually, that coincides because the moon is what? How big compared to the Earth? It's a sixth of the size, a fifth of the size, roughly?
Yeah, it depends on if you're talking mass or diameter. I think if you're talking diameter, then that's probably correct.
Probably more mass just because it would be the effect of the gravity on it, which would be more related to the mass of the object rather than the diameter. But yeah, I mean, whether that math definitely is fuzzy and isn't exact, but it's just proportionally, it's probably about the same, give or take for some atmosphere. But that's super interesting. That's very cool. Some of the other conspiracies that we see and hear a lot about are, you know, crosshairs that are behind objects instead of in front of them. And that was proven when you look at the original prints. That the crosshairs are, in fact, not even there. And the copies that they make are when those crosshairs get placed in front. It's something called a Rousseau plate, which is a piece of glass that's used to make copies, or was back in the day. And that's where those crosshairs came from. But my favorite theory here is that the flag is waving in the pictures when the astronauts are standing there with the American flag. And what they don't seem to realize is that it was affixed to an L-shaped rod to allow it to stand up, because we had the foresight. Here goes technology. We were able to get to the moon. We also had the foresight that the flag would just go straight down or just not do anything unless we affixed it in a certain position for our awesome photo ops. And so it's an L-shaped rod, and it doesn't move. And in fact, there's a couple of sequence of photos that you can look at online where you see an astronaut moving his hand as they're taking different pictures, and the flag is affixed in a position where it kind of looks like it was waving, but it's just the position of the material, and it doesn't move as his hand goes up and down. And so that one, I think they debunked pretty quickly.
Having nothing to do with whether or not we landed on the moon, that waving flag on its L-shaped bracket is now apparently white due to the fact that there is no atmosphere to protect the flag from UV radiation. So it's just gotten completely bleached.
That's a shame. Well, it's a good thing that we're going back in 2024, where we'll hopefully be setting up shop to start building some rocket fuel and get ourselves a new flag there, as well as some new people to walk on the moon, including the first female astronaut to set foot on the moon, who they are in the process of selecting. Woo-hoo. And that's also something that we're going to be talking about on our next episode, which is going to be focused on NASA and our exploration of the solar system and how that organization is evolving. Before we go, a couple of things that I think we need to do in this episode. There is a place that orbits the Earth, and this is a dark and cold place, and it's a place that you don't ever want to go. And this place is called Space Jail. It's for people that say outlandish things at outlandish times. And I can confidently say today in this episode, we have our first inmate. Now, Nathan, I'll give you 30 seconds to plead your case. But because you think, or at least give credit to the hoaxers and people who say we didn't land on the moon, you are on trial, my friend, to go.
Oh, boy.
So I think the whole concept of a space jail is brilliant, because you build a facility on the moon, you send the evildoers there, and...
Nathan, we love you, but you are sequestered to the space jail. And the rules of space jail are going to be that in order to get out of space jail, someone else needs to go to space jail. Good news is we'll likely be putting somebody in space jail every episode. So you won't have to spend more than a week in there, Nate.
Can we visit him in space jail? Because I'll miss him.
Yeah, you got to take the space elevator.
Yeah, it might be cost prohibitive, but you can try, Mark.
I'm coming, Nate. I'll come see you.
Put you in space jail, Alex.
On a lighter note, we also have to give a space award out today. And just given that amazing research and amazing knowledge in Thea and how the moon was created, Alex, I think you are our space award winner today.
All right.
Woo!
Very excited. This is a top five moment in my life so far. So thank you, Todd.
Fantastic. Well, listen, Alex, I want to give you the opportunity to give us our send-off words today. So any parting words, any words of wisdom to close the episode out?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just glad for all you Zelda players out there that the moon is moving away from us and not towards us like in Majora's Mask, because that would be highly unfortunate.
Wow. Very nerdy, Alex. You sound like you come straight from Hyrule. All right, everybody. We'll see you on the next
episode.
Very
nerdy coming from a person who runs a space podcast.
All right, you guys. We'll see you on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in to the Space Cadets Podcast.